a bigger theater. We think there's a demand for it. People are loving it. Let's try our hand on the big stage. And it worked, and it won the Tony Awards that year, and for the two writing awards for score and script, and best musical, we beat Wicked. It surprised the hell out of everyone.
Could part of the show's success be because there's a lot of puppet nudity?
Not a lot. I mean, there's a puppet sex scene. Of course, a lot of it is imagined because they're like Muppets. They're only waist up, so there's no genitals. It's all in the imagination of our dirty audiences.
So this is your story,
but without genitals.
Yeah, no, it wasn't that aspect was fictional. You know, we have genitals.
I've heard that your writing partner Bobby Lopez has a significant musical theater handicap.
But yeah, no, he's married and has kids and he's straight. People always assumed he was gay. Actually, our agent, when he sent us out on meetings, he usually used to say the one that seems gay is actually straight and the one that seems straight is actually gay. which he wasn't very pleased about that setup. Our director was gay, our book writer was gay, two of our three producers were gay, you know, a lot of our actors are gay. I mean, it's theater.
This has been a conversation with Avenue Q co-creator Jeff Marks. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
If you were gay, that'd be okay. I mean, 'cause hey, I'd like you anyway, because you see, if it were me, I would feel free to say that I was gay, but I'm not gay.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Chris Wilson, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Dixie Treichel and John Townsend, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KDHX St. Louis, Missouri, 2BBB Bellingen, New South Wales, WBCR Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Hey, it's Jeep Ward here. You're listening to 89.5 FM Bridgeport WPKN and 88.7 FM Montauk WPKM and on the World Wide Web at WPKN.org.
Well, that came out of left field. It's 8 o'clock, and this is WPKN of Bridgeport, as the band said. And I want to welcome you to Counterpoint coming up next, but also remind you that the preceding program, This Way Out, can be heard every Monday evening between 7:30 and 8 p.m. That's Monday evening, 7:30 and 8 p.m., This Way Out. Right now, stay tuned for Counterpoint coming up next.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not a
of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here every Monday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. bringing you news and views and analysis of important issues of the day from perspectives you won't hear in the corporate media very often. And we're glad you could join us this fine Monday evening here in April. After a little cold and a little rain that maybe felt a little bit in conflict with the global warming trend, but maybe that's a good sign. At any rate, thank you all for joining us tonight. We have a lot to cover this evening, so I'll let you know we've got on tap this evening Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator of Healthcare Now, an organization that's pushing for passage of national single-payer healthcare legislation known as H.R. 676. We're going to be talking about that. A little later, Seth Adler will be joining us from Left Form, a gathering of progressive intellectuals and activists that's going to be taking place in New York City at Pace University this coming weekend, April 17th through 19th. So we'll find out more about that group, Left Form. And we also have Jorge Mujica here. He's going to tell you more about the March 10th Coalition, which put together those enormous immigrants' rights demonstrations and protests all over the country back in 2006, when it looked like Congress might be poised to pass comprehensive immigration reform legislation, and there was a lot of dissension about where that was headed. I think those protests in the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions, and in very real sense, derailed some of what was about to happen back then in Congress. And there are new opportunities for legislation this year and new protests planned this May Day by immigrants and the immigrant rights supporters around the country. We'll find out more about that. And right now I'd like to introduce our first guest, who is Joanne Mariner. She is director of Human Rights Watch Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program. And Joanne, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
And we have been covering what's been going on in terms of the revelations, large and small, about U.S. abuse and torture of prisoners held since the September 11th attacks. And I think there is some a new dimension of the information that was released just this past week with the posting of a confidential report by the International Committee of the Red Cross on abuse and torture at U.S. CIA-run secret prisons. Now, this was a report, I understand, that was issued in 2007, but only made public by Mark Danner, a writer and journalist professor, that he posted on the New York Review of Books website last week. And people can see that for themselves at nybooks.com. I'll repeat that. But maybe you could summarize for us, Joanne, the importance of this revelation of the International Committee of the Red Cross report and what it contributes to the debate on where we go from here regarding the Bush administration authorization of torture.
The importance of the report is that the Red Cross had access to the 14 so-called high-value detainees who were transferred from CIA custody to Guantanamo in September 2006. And these were some of whom had been held literally for many years. I mean, the first one was picked up in, I believe it was January 2002. So they'd been held more than 4 years, some of them, at the time they were transferred to Guantanamo. And no one who's spoken to them has been able to make public what these detainees had to say about their treatment. So right now they have access to counsel, but these counsel are under gag orders, and they're unable to. Their notes have to be declassified, and their notes aren't declassified. And when these guys are in court, I was down at Guantanamo a few months ago watching them in court, and there's a 20-second delay. So if they say anything that the CIA does not want to be made public, it's censored. The sound is cut, and you don't hear. So this report is the first glimpse we've had at these guys and what the Red Cross found, and of course they're very, very authoritative in issuing these findings, is that these men were subject to severe forms of torture. The CIA report clearly uses the word torture. It uses the word inhuman treatment, cruel treatment, and it goes into detail about how these men were treated. They were waterboarded, some of them, at least three of them. They were beaten. They were hung up by their arms for days at a time, stopped from sleeping, sexually humiliated, held naked for months, just sort of basic kind of, you know, fairly medieval forms of torture. And this is an authoritative report that, that makes those findings and now makes them publicly.
Joanne, maybe before we get into some of the details of the report and again, where we go from here in this country, you could talk a little bit about how the Red Cross operates. They operate primarily, as I understand it, in secrecy, and they view the leak of this confidential document as deplorable. But maybe you could speak about how the Red Cross, you know, addresses the abuse of prisoners. They get access, but they must keep it secret. So you wonder, well, what's the end result if they find prisoners are being abused, but they can't say anything publicly? How does that help the prisoners' cause?
It really depends on the situation. But the idea, I think part of the idea behind Red Cross access is that people doing the torturing may not have orders to do so. It might be abuse that's being carried out, you know, without the knowledge of the highest level officials. So the Red Cross doesn't just inform, you know, the head of a prison. The Red Cross reports go to the very top of a government. So they go to the president and, you know, the Secretary of Defense and whoever else is at the very, very top of the hierarchy. And the idea is they are putting them on, you know, notice that these kinds of abuses are going on. Now, I think in this case, the very top of the administration was fully aware of these abuses. I mean, we know from a lot of very good reporting in the Washington Post and the New York Times that the Oval Office was meeting and was, you know, essentially monitoring, overseeing, and mandating the abuse of these detainees. So probably, you know, nothing in the Red Cross report came as a surprise to the very senior level officials that were in control of this program. But that's a general idea. And of course, the Red Cross does operate under a rule of confidentiality. So even though it informs the government, it also informs members of, you know, certain specific members of Congress, it does not make its reports public, and this report was leaked.
Can we assume that members of the Bush administration saw this report and did nothing to rein in the torture being administered to these prisoners?
Well, the interesting thing is that even though the Red Cross doesn't make its information public, the Red Cross didn't have access to any of these men while they were in CIA custody. And that's one of the hallmarks of this CIA detention program, is people are held without any access to any neutral person, and certainly any person that would be on their side in any way. So, of course, no access to counsel, no access to a family member, but no access to a, you know, impartial judge, no access even to the Red Cross, which has the strict rule of confidentiality. So the Red Cross didn't see these people until they were transferred to military custody, which is when, you know, the waterboarding and all that wasn't occurring anymore. So, you know, it wasn't that the Bush administration could be informed and they would put a stop to it. It was already over. They, you know, some of these people literally had been held for years. I doubt there was even much point in interrogating them anymore.
We're speaking with Joanne Mariner, Director of Human Rights Watch, Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program. And Joanne, I wanted to ask you about the conclusion that the Red Cross reached here. As you said just a moment ago, they determined that the treatment of these U.S.-held detainees amounted to torture and violated United States and international law. Now, how much weight does that carry when the Red Cross says it versus a politician here in the United States or even a human rights organization like yours?
I think it carries a lot of weight because under the Geneva Conventions, the Red Cross really is sort of the guardian of the Geneva Conventions. They have an official role. They are the legal experts. They have, you know, people who've spent, you know, high-level lawyers who spent their lives studying international law and studying the Geneva Conventions. And they really, you know, they're not sort of a lobbying organization. They're not at all a lobbying organization. So when they come out with a finding, it carries a lot of weight. And I think, you know, this is an authoritative finding that the CIA program amounted to torture. We've also had, of course, the new Attorney General, Eric Holder, in his confirmation hearings, acknowledging that waterboarding was a form of torture. And U.S. courts in the past prosecuted waterboarding as torture. So, you know, and of course, any international law expert you'll ever speak to will tell you that waterboarding is torture. So I think, you know, now it's beyond doubt that these people were subject to waterboarding and subject to torture.
Now, to get into some more of the details of this report, which is quite horrifying, I read summaries of it which said some of these detainees claimed that they were threatened with electric shocks, infection with HIV, the HIV virus, sodomy, violence against their families, and being brought close to death. What can you say that would best sort of get across to our listeners exactly the kind of not only humiliation and degradation and torture that these individuals were going into, but I would think you might have to say that it was real terror that they were undergoing.
Yeah, I think the interrogators were trying to prove in every possible way, from physical violence to intimidation, to taking people into a place where they, you know, absolutely weren't sleeping, so were completely disoriented. They were trying to show to them that they were being held beyond the law, that there was no protection, and they were completely at the mercy of their captors. That's also the reason for barring the Red Cross. They wanted the detainees to feel that there was nobody in the world who knew where they were, nobody in the world that can help them, and that they were, you know, completely at the mercy of their captors, which is, you know, we think of these things happening in some dark hole in Egypt, in Syria. We don't really think of our own officials carrying out these kinds of abuses, but I think we have to acknowledge at this point that it happens.
You issued a recent report about how the nation of Jordan and their intelligence service acted as a proxy jailer for these CIA prisoners from 2001 to at least 2004. You want to say a word about these secret sites and what you found out specifically about Jordan?
Yeah, that was, I mean, there. I think essentially there were two stages to the CIA program. There was the first year or so after September 11th, couple of years, I think there was a very small capacity for the CIA to be holding people itself. So a lot of people were delivered to other countries. We know of some 15 detainees approximately who were delivered to Jordan, where they were held in proxy detention. I mean, these were non-Jordanians, and people that there's no reason to believe the Jordanians had any real interest in. But I think there's very close relationship between the Jordanian intelligence services and the CIA, so they were holding them, interrogating them, and unfortunately also torturing them as a favor to the CIA. And these people were later returned to CIA custody, many of them. Later, when the CIA developed its own program, you know, as we read in this report, the CIA was holding fairly large numbers of prisoners and carrying out its own abuses. But in the early years in particular, the CIA relied on several countries. It relied on Jordan. I think Jordan was the country that held the largest number of prisoners. We also know that it held at least three prisoners in Morocco, and that it held some number of people, or it delivered some number of people to Egypt. And of course Syria, the case of Maher Arar, the Canadian who was delivered there in October 2002. So, you know, the CIA worked with the abusive countries, and then it carried out those same abuses itself.
Now, the report, this Red Cross report, also asserted that medical officers who oversaw interrogations violated medical ethics and in some cases essentially participated in torture. You want to say a word about that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the idea behind the medical profession is to provide care and treatment, that it is a profession that is on the side of the person who is being cared for. But what the Red Cross found in this case is that the medical officers were there not to in any way help the detainee or provide care, but were there to make sure he didn't die while the torture was going on, and to, you know, help explain explore the detainees' vulnerability. So they were part of the system of abuse. They were not in any way there to help out the person being abused. And that, of course, is a, you know, fundamental violation of the Hippocratic Oath and of the very idea of providing medical care. And so the Red Cross report was very critical of that aspect of it and really condemned the presence of these medical professionals in CIA interrogation.
Now, President Barack Obama, when he took office, he's issued an executive order that ended harsh interrogation or torture, waterboarding, and the like, anything outside of the U.S. Army field manual and what it allows. We have Leon Panetta, Obama's new director of the CIA, who asserts that no one who participated in this torture and abuse should be investigated or prosecuted. What's your take on that? How do you react to the assertion, without any real contradiction from President Obama himself, that these torturers, whoever they are, and presumably not just those in the cells performing the torture, but those who ordered it above, should be beyond the reach of the law?
Well, it's, of course, very disappointing, and it is somewhat in contradiction with the idea that we don't want these abuses to occur again, because just, you know, generally the criminal justice system is based on a principle of deterrence. So when you punish something, that's how you ensure that it doesn't happen. When people know they're going to be punished, if these CIA interrogators thought they were going to go to jail, they wouldn't have carried out these abuses. So if we want to prevent them in the future, we don't just turn the page and, you know, provide amnesty to everyone and not even require any kind of truth-telling process. What we do is we carry out investigations and we prosecute people. So I think, you know, if the administration is serious about not allowing these kinds of things to happen again, it shouldn't be just letting everybody who carried out these abuses off the hook. And I think, you know, more importantly than the interrogators themselves, what the Obama administration is doing is letting the Bush administration and the senior officials who ordered these abuses off the hook. Because, you know, nobody looks at the interrogator as the main culprit. The main culprit are the people who formulated these policies, who decided to go down this route, and who made orders, sent orders down the chain of command, and you know, told these interrogators to treat detainees in this way. And the high-level Bush administrations could have made very different choices and should have made very different choices.
We're speaking tonight with Joanne Mariner here on Counterpoint. She's director of Human Rights Watch's Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program, and we're talking about a leaked confidential report issued by the International Committee of the Red Cross detailing what 14 high-value detainees held by the CIA had told them in confidence about their abuse and torture at the hands of their CIA jailers. Joanne, the Obama position on prosecution is, at least what he says publicly, is, I want to look forward, I don't want to look back. But yet there have been some in Congress that have proposed a truth commission. There are a lot of people out in the human rights community, including possibly your group, that hopes for the appointment of a special prosecutor and an investigation and eventual prosecution of those who aided and abetted and authorized torture. Where do you think things are headed now?
Well, we haven't had any encouraging signs, really not a whole lot on either front. Certainly in terms of prosecutions, Obama himself has made sort of sent a lot of coded signals about, you know, looking forward, not backward, that indicate prosecutions are unlikely. Holder has made similar comments. And now last week, Leon Panetta sent a message around to the CIA, which, you know, included some good aspects. It said the prisons are no longer operating, no detainees are being rendered, etc. But it also said that it just bluntly said that criminal prosecutions were inappropriate. So that has not been, that, you know, doesn't make the likelihood of prosecution seem very likely to happen. On the idea of a truth commission, Senator Patrick Leahy made a speech about a month and a half ago where he proposed such a commission. And John Conyers in the House has actually put forward legislation that would create such a commission. But we haven't really seen the idea gaining a lot of momentum. We haven't seen a lot of other senators get behind it, and particularly there haven't been any even moderate Republican senators that have voiced, you know, even cautious support for the idea. So, you know, with all the other competing imperatives right now with the economic crisis and so forth, there really haven't been a lot of signs that this administration is going to put the political capital into pushing this idea forward that would be necessary. So, I mean, it's no surprise that given that vacuum, you know, given one clear, you know, an obvious recognition with this report and other reports that abuses occurred, and given the lack of interest domestically, I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing this Spanish case that your listeners may have heard of, where now there is a Spanish judge that's looking into bringing charges against some high U.S. officials for actually the lawyers who wrote the legal memoranda authorizing torture.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go next. Do you think the combination of this leaked Red Cross report on torture and the Spanish prosecutor Baltasar Garzon and his initiating an investigation of the six former Bush administration legal advisors, architects of the U.S. torture policy, will that put sufficient pressure on the Obama administration to change course and actively pursue an investigation and prosecution if warranted, do you think?
I think both the report and now the idea of possible Spanish prosecutions do create some pressure. And, you know, there's other things that are going to be happening in the future that I think will create additional pressure. There's a Senate Armed Services Committee report that should be issued any day now. We keep hearing rumors that it's going to be issued, you know, tomorrow or the next day. But it was a report that the executive summary of it was issued last December, but it's a very long and, you know, comprehensively documented report and very, very critical. And it essentially finds, you know, it says there's, you know, good reason to believe that Donald Rumsfeld and others are responsible for war crimes. So that report will create additional pressure. There is another report by the Office of Professional Responsibility that analyzes the...
Oops. I think we lost you, Joanne. Wow. We got to finish this conversation up, listeners. I'm just as surprised as you are. We lost Joanne. But let me try her back, and why don't you hold on there, and we will endeavor to get Joanne back on the line to finish our conversation. In the meantime, listen to this important message. We'll be back in a moment.
Last fall, Slow Leap released their third CD, New Century Blues. Goldmine said, "It's a groove-oriented, funked-up monster of dark, down-and-dirty electronica and traditional blues rock. So hot and steamy, it practically sizzles. The record melts asphalt." On Saturday, May 2nd, 9:30 p.m., Slow Leap will drag the blues into the 21st century and into Two Boots Restaurant for a WPKN benefit concert. Slow Leap is the vision of Charlie Karp and Danny Cooch Korchmar. Charlie Karp is well known to blues audiences in the area. He was a member of Buddy Miles Express and was the frontman in White Chocolate and Charlie Karp and the Name Droppers. Recently, Charlie burned down the house with some distinguished friends at the Jam for Carl. Ask anyone who was there. Danny Korchmar is a music industry heavyweight. He co-wrote Somebody's Baby with Jackson Browne and New York Minute with Don Henley. He's an in-demand session player and has played guitar on albums by Buddy Guy, Etta James, Warren Zevon, James Taylor, David Crosby, and Graham.
That event's coming up Saturday, May 2nd at Two Boots, and it's a benefit for this station, WPKN Radio. Right now, I want to get back to Joanne Mariner. We got disconnected. We want to finish up our conversation. Joanne, apologies for that. Don't know what happened. But you were in the minute, you were sort of talking about the things that were about to happen. And you talked about the Senate Armed Services Committee report, executive summary. You're talking about war crimes committed by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld And you were just about to get to another point, I believe.
Yeah, there's a report by the Office of Professional Responsibility in the Justice Department that, I mean, we've long heard about it, and we have an understanding that it basically destroys the reasoning of the legal memos that tried to justify torture, and finds that the authors of those memos were responsible for, you know, serious malpractice, essentially. So that report, too, I think, will help create pressure for the administration to take these past abuses seriously.
Well, I guess what I'd like to conclude with here, Joanne, is the fact that we have former Vice President Dick Cheney going around telling the country that if it wasn't for the torture and abuse of these detainees, that the U.S. would have seen another deadly attack on our country. And there are certainly more than a few people in the nation that are convinced that this is the right course of action. In fact, I'll just do a quick quote of former Vice President Cheney when he said on February 4th of this year, just a couple months ago, he said, quote, "If it hadn't been for what we did with respect to the enhanced interrogation techniques for high-value detainees, then we would have been attacked again. Those policies we put in place, in my opinion, were absolutely crucial to getting us through the last 7-plus years without a major casualty attack on the U.S. How do you respond to that? And what kinds of public pressure do you think should be brought on our congressional representatives and the government in general to follow through here and prosecute war crimes if they occurred?
Well, I would just respond that there are quite a number of counterterrorism experts, people who make a living not, you know, promoting human rights, but really looking at what drives militant groups, who absolutely disagree with Cheney and believe that the abuses of the past 7.5 years were an incredible recruitment tool for militant groups. And, you know, if you go to the website, there are many websites that are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda and, you know, other militant groups in the world. They are covered with pictures of Abu Ghraib, the famous photos we all know. They talk about, you know, the U.S. government is in a war against Islam, and the leading evidence that they use is Guantanamo, is Abu Ghraib, is CIA prisons. So, I mean, I think the idea that these abuses make us safer is very short-sighted. Many people believe these abuses are terribly counterproductive. But I think, you know, the fact that he can feel that he can make those claims and defend these abuses shows that there's a need to have some kind of a commission, a really, you know, authoritative, credible body to look at his claims, to look at what happened, and to analyze it and, you know, bring out the truth to the public and let a real public debate begin. And I think, you know, your listeners should be pressuring members of Congress to push that for that to happen.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Joanne, for all you do in the realm of human rights, and leave our listeners with a website or any other information that they may secure in terms of getting a better understanding of this Red Cross report and all the work you do around human rights in this country and around the world.
Well, great. Yeah, we have a website at www.hrw.org that has a set of our recommendations to the new administration as to how they should be dealing with these past crimes, and it provides a lot of information about what we've been discussing.
And
so it would be great if people could visit it.
Yeah, hrw.org, and I'll also just mention that this leaked Red Cross report can be read in its entirety. It was a PDF file you can download from the New York Review of Books site, which is simply nybooks.com, nybooks.com. Joanne, thank you again for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Joanne Mariner, Director of Human Rights Watch's Terrorism and Counterterrorism Program. And this is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris. We'll continue on in just a little bit with a discussion of universal health care and some options for single health care that are not really getting its due in terms of the debate in the country. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
We'll get rid of the dictator, rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go to school. We'll clean up the cities, get the sewage plants running, institute parliamentary rule. We'll bring you autonomy, senators and judges, and a shiny new blue banner. We'll bring you pride and prosperity, food in your bellies, and every home a phone, fax, and scanner. After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run. We'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners, the oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free. After we torture our prisoners, you'll all be safe with us to protect you and keep you out of harm's way. You'll thank creation and your liberties from the dark into a new day. After we torture our prisoners, you can all jump for joy, each girl and boy, and look boldly into the distance. You'll be so happy for all that we've done for such invaluable assistance. After we torture our prisoners, you won't have to worry about tyrants and bullies now that you have sovereignty. You can hold your head high, kiss Saddam goodbye, say hello to democracy. After we torture our prisoners, after we torture our prisoners.
David Rovics, hearing a lot from him in that particular song after we review issues like this International Committee of the Red Cross report on U.S. abuse and torture of U.S. held detainees in secret CIA sites, including Bagram Air Base and Guantanamo Bay detention camp down there in Cuba. So we're giving that song quite a workout, and it's a sad situation, of course, and hopefully we will take heed to what Joanne Mariner suggested at Human Rights Watch, to really dig in our heels and say, we are a country of laws, and we don't countenance torture in our name. And the way to do that is to contact your representative in Washington and let them know you want an investigation and prosecution if war crimes indeed were committed in our name. For more information, again, go to hrw.org. HumanRightsWatch.org. And right now I'd like to welcome to the program Katie Robbins. She's Assistant National Coordinator of a group called Healthcare Now. Katie, thanks for making time for our conversation tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott.
It's very exciting. I was down at the March on Wall Street a couple Saturdays ago, mm-hmm. and I ran into a table there and a little peace and justice fair that occurred after the march by the New York Stock Exchange, protesting against war and for economic equality and all those good things. But I saw a table that your group had, Healthcare Now, and I was very happily surprised to find that there is a grassroots organizing effort nationally to push for single-payer health care. And I'd known certainly about a lot of efforts around the country, but I guess now is the critical time for this to kick in, given that newly elected President Barack Obama is talking about setting aside money and has already convened a summit to begin discussions about where healthcare reform is going. But, Katie, maybe you can begin by telling our listeners about Healthcare Now and your mission.
Sure, I'm happy to. Healthcare Now started about 5 years ago in a living room in New York City. It, as the story goes, it was a small group of thoughtful and committed citizens who are devoted to the fact that healthcare is a human right. And it was shortly after the launch, or the first time H.R. 676 was introduced by Congressman Conyers. And H.R. 676 is, of course, the U.S. National Healthcare Act, which, if implemented, would successfully provide a single-payer national health care system for the people of this country. And since that small group of people started about 5 years ago, Healthcare Now has grown into a national advocacy campaign. for single-payer national health care. We're active in over 40 states. We have volunteer organizers in most of the major cities of this country, as well as some very rural areas in between, who are devoted to pushing this issue through their local organizing efforts. And Healthcare Now works to coordinate those efforts. We provide a way for all of these activists to communicate and share ideas with one another. And it's really an amazing, energetic, and fast-growing movement in this country.
And maybe you can explain this particular piece of legislation, H.R. 676, as you stated, is sponsored by Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. And I know it's basically summarized as saying it's the Medicare for All bill that goes beyond just senior citizens, but really transfers that that large system covering people over a certain age, 65 or whatever, and covers everyone. But maybe you can explain a lot better than I can.
Sure. I'm happy to make the case for H.R. 676. Currently, our healthcare system is failing, and that's something that maybe many of your listeners agree with, but just to highlight some of the problems that we face with our healthcare system so that we understand the importance of 676 is that, you know, we have a huge number of uninsured people in this country, 49 million, and an additional 14,000 are losing their insurance every day since this economic downturn. And in addition, a huge number of bankruptcies are due to medical debt. In fact, 50% of all bankruptcies are because of medical debt, and 70% of those bankruptcies had insurance at the time of illness. Children in many parts of the country today who are born today have a shorter life expectancy than their parents, and it's really phenomenal to wrap your mind around the actual number of people who die because they don't have health insurance. 18,000 to 22,000 people die each year because they don't have health insurance, and that does not happen in any other industrialized country in the world. So with H.R. 676, it's essentially, as you said, it takes Medicare, a system that has worked for over 40 years in this country, providing comprehensive care to people over 65 years of age, and it improves that system, because Medicare admittedly does have some problems, and expands it to everyone. So we call that a single-payer system because that refers to essentially the financing of our health care. A single-payer national health insurance system would be a public agency that organizes the health financing. But the delivery of care remains private, so it's still privately run doctors and hospitals. H.R. 676 is comprehensive in the care that it provides. Essentially, all medically necessary care will be covered. That's including doctor, hospital, long-term care, mental health, dental, vision, prescription drug, and medical supply costs. And people might ask, well, how do we cover comprehensive care for everyone under a single-payer system? Well, it's through the cost savings by removing the waste of the private insurance industry. The private health insurance industry is responsible for wasting up to a third of our health care dollars on administrative costs, on CEO salaries, profits, anything but health care. And that's the key. Removing the private insurance industry and those profit motives will provide enough cost savings to extend comprehensive coverage to everyone in this country. And that's what the single-payer movement is calling for, a real debate on what is the role of private insurance in our healthcare? What are they doing? We know we need doctors and hospitals to survive. Do we need a private health insurance industry? And the answer from the single-payer perspective is no, we don't.
Well, the insurance industry, of course, has a lot of clout in Washington, D.C., and around the rest of the country. They have enormous amounts of money to push their agenda, and they, of course, don't want to see themselves go extinct, so they're fighting this tooth and nail, and they've pretty much succeeded in excluding single payer as an option from the debate, have they not?
It's been disappointing. The single payer movement certainly has worked hard for the small successes we have seen in the debate thus far in the current administration, but you're absolutely right that it's an incredible amount of energy and money the industry is able to expend to keep their failed policies in place. And we really suspect that we haven't seen anything yet. There's some murmurings of a multi-million dollar campaign with TV commercials circulating. But the big argument that is so frustrating that they're able to tout is they say, you know, you don't want government making healthcare decisions for you when it should be up to the doctor and the patient. But today we know it's not the doctor and the patient making these decisions, it's the insurance company. So we have this corporate bureaucracy and this corporate greed that has a stranglehold over our medical system. And the single payer movement has been trying to expose that, but it's difficult getting media coverage, and that's also linked to insurance industry money. Locally here in New York, we targeted Congressman Rangel, who is the chair of the very powerful Ways and Means Committee, which has jurisdiction over health care reform, and they're going to start having hearings. They already have started having hearings. And we dug up that, you know, while he has co-sponsored H.R. 676 in the past, he hasn't signed on again this year. And this also coincides with the fact that his insurance industry contributions have gone up threefold since 2004. So this is really, a shocking correlation that we're seeing across the board. We are challenging it by organizing locally and showing that while the insurance industry has money, we have the votes, and we're able to show that the polls are in favor. The public favors the national healthcare system. Physicians currently favor a national healthcare system, but the popular argument is, well, it's not politically feasible. If it's not politically feasible, it's not because the public doesn't want it. They do. It's not politically feasible because the insurance industry is pumping money into a system that doesn't work.
And, of course, campaign finance reform has a lot to do with ending this undue influence, which really kind of distorts and derails good policies that mm-hmm. could benefit us all. I know we've been talking about that with Nick Neihardt of Public Campaign. And on so many instances, and particularly healthcare, you can see how these lobbyists really derail a lot of these important issues and solutions to them. So I would just ask you, Katie Robbins, to talk about President Obama. What is President Obama's position as of right now? He's in the Oval Office. What does he want to do with health care? Is it clear yet what direction he might want to take health care reform?
Yeah, Obama's position is interesting. It has evolved over the past 5 years, really. In 2003, there's a YouTube clip that has been circulating showing him stating his very eloquent support for a single-payer system. And then we've seen that that position sort of step to the center as he, moved up the ranks of political positions. And when he was campaigning, he did say if we were starting from scratch, he would support a single-payer system. But he is now touting that we need to build on what we have, and that we should. He did campaign on the idea of a public option competing with private insurance. But it's really not clear what his position is. He did issue a number of principles that he wants healthcare reform to match up to, and has sort of left the details to Congress. And what we say is, from the single payer perspective, the debate that we're really calling for is, you know, any reform that maintains the private insurance industry, even if there is a comprehensive public option to compete with it, will not be universal, and it will not contain costs. So these ideas that he campaigned on in providing universal health care and health care as a human right really won't come to fruition in the reform that is being talked about on the legislative level in Congress. And what we're really calling for is a healthy debate, if you will. A single-payer system would cover everyone, and it would save upwards of $400 billion. So we're not sure exactly what the reform will look like. There's definitely going to be a legislative battle, and I think that there's a spectrum of policies that are on the table, if you will, ranging from the idea of mandating the purchase of insurance for all individuals in this country, which is one of the most regressive ways to provide a national health care system. That's actually the model that is being used in Massachusetts right now. and they're claiming it, touting this mandate model as a success. Something like 98% of people are covered, but other reports are showing that it's much less. The mandate model is does subsidize policies for people who are under 300% of the poverty level. And as soon as you're at 301%, you're thrown into the private insurance market. And the plans that are available to you range on these gold, silver, and bronze status. The most affordable in quotes plan has a very high copays and deductibles that go along with a smaller monthly premium. And many families have been exempted from purchasing insurance because it's actually unaffordable under this system. But many of these flaws are not being talked about in mainstream media or in the Congress, though some really wonderful reports have come out from our allied organizations, Physicians for a National Health Program, on the failures of the Massachusetts plan. So that's one spectrum, that mandate model, that's one side of the spectrum in healthcare reform. And then another option, the idea that we should have a public option competing with our private insurance. But there's absolutely no definition of the public option at this time. So advocates for health reform, especially on the single-payer perspective, are having a real problem with the idea that we don't know what this public option covers. We don't know any of the policy details of it. So supporting it is really difficult to do when it's undefined. So we're still out here calling for the single-payer perspective to be involved in all congressional hearings and a Congressional Budget Office report. And that's really the strength that the single-payer movement has right now is demanding a fair debate.
Well, it didn't get off to a very good start, did it? On March 5th, President Obama convened a health care reform summit in Washington, and advocates of single-payer were excluded from that debate until you guys made some noise, right?
It was a successful pressure campaign on our part, and it was exciting to see the single-payer movement sort of flex its muscle because we've been building it for such a long time. The health reform summit at the White House that Obama called did have some single-payer supporters in some of the co-sponsors in Congress of 676, but Congressman Conyers and representative from Physicians for a National Health Program, Dr. Oliver Fine, were excluded, and after thousands of phone calls going into the White House, the doors were open to them, which we did see as a small success. And then subsequently, the White House called for these regional White House forums that occurred in five different places, Dearborn, Michigan, Burlington, Vermont, Greensboro, North Carolina, Des Moines, Iowa, and then all culminating with an event out in L.A. And we had successful demonstrations in front of each of these forums with people inside and outside advocating for single payer. It was interesting, though, the message did become more tightly controlled as the forums continued. The Dearborn, Michigan forum, I had report backs from activists saying it was like an H.R. 676 rally. And then all the way through to L.A. where the message became more controlled and single-payer advocates actually weren't even allowed to speak inside of the forum. So we're seeing an interesting response from the White House where we did get some success in that they invited representatives to the forum, and we had press at all of the demonstrations at the regional forums. It seems like they're really trying to hush the momentum for single-payer.
We're speaking tonight on Counterpoint with Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator of the group Healthcare Now, which is promoting national health insurance single-payer style through the legislation called H.R. 676, primary sponsor being Michigan Congressman John Conyers, Democrat. And Katie, wanted to ask you about the media. It seems like the corporate media is also, not surprisingly, given the money they get from big insurance advertisements, are pretty much excluding single payer as a health care reform option from the national debate as well. And we had an example of that, and it wasn't even corporate TV, it was public television. Frontline, the award-winning documentary series, had a documentary titled Sick Around America, But there was a lot of criticism that they really did not frame the whole issue of what is possible in terms of health care reform in this country, given a profit versus non-profit health care alternatives, such as we have around the world and in Europe. And we'll get to Europe and talk about that before we say goodnight this evening. But tell us a little bit about corporate media and what's been good or not so good there.
Well, we were happy to see a wonderful report come out of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting on the media blackout on single payer. And they did some digging, and over the course of a month from February 25th, it was really hundreds of stories in major newspapers that they on health reform that they searched, and only 18 of these stories made any mention of single payer. And usually when single payer is mentioned in mainstream media, it's done with that sort of disparaging tone, which is really frustrating because it shows that the media isn't doing their job in educating people about single payer, and this rhetoric really just confuses rather than informs people, and it blurs the lines between what it is that we're talking about. So the fact that the media isn't doing their job and informing people of exactly what single payer is extremely problematic. We can assume that part of that reason is that, you know, the insurance industry and big pharma are their major contributors, especially since the economic downturn. So it may be getting even more severe. And progressive radio and outlets have really been trying to highlight this fact that single payer has been left out of the debate. PBS and the Frontline show Sick Around America was really disappointing to see this film, which it's still available for free online on the Frontline's website, and it was the sequel to a really excellent film, Sick Around the World, which featured healthcare systems in five different countries and how they are able to provide comprehensive care to all of their citizens. And the tone, the difference between Sick Around the World and Sick Around America was extremely notable. Sick Around America really felt almost like a corporate takeover. While we didn't expect Sick Around America to take a position on reform, we didn't think that it would be touting it, the industry, as the only solution to reform, which it really did. It starred Karen Ignani, the president of AHIP, the American Health Insurance Plans, several times, and the stories that it highlighted, while maybe were a spectrum of or a cross-section of what people in this country experience with insurance, largely, you know, maybe not being able to access insurance even if they can't afford it, or these exorbitant medical bills, it really missed the chance to say something meaningful about health reform. And it didn't mention single payer or the single payer movement or people who advocate for the removal of for-profit private insurance companies from the system to provide comprehensive care. And there was a bit of a background scuffle because T.R. Reid, who was very involved with Sick Around the World, also did researching and reporting for Sick Around America, and he pulled out at the last minute. And it seemed that he didn't agree with the tone that the film took and decided that he didn't want his name associated with it. And it really comes down to the idea that it goes, Sick Around America really went against what his research showed. The countries that were highlighted in Sick Around the World, while some had a multiple paying system, the critical thing to know is that insurers, health insurers, are highly regulated and non-profit. You cannot have a functioning healthcare system when there is a middleman making huge profits off your health care, and that's the real failure of the U.S. system. Sick Around America really failed to highlight that aspect.
Well, Katie, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you this. Maybe you could debunk a couple of the myths that we always hear about Canada and some of the universal health care systems around other places in the world, such as Europe, where there's the claim that there's rationing and people aren't getting good care, and how the U.S. has the best health care system in the world, despite the fact that we exclude, you know, 47 million people from it, from participating in it. But Maybe you could respond to that and also leave our listeners with an idea of how this grassroots campaign for single-payer health care coverage is going forward.
I'm happy to. Well, as far as the myths go, especially the idea that the United States has the best healthcare system in the world, is absolutely not true. We're ranked 37th in healthcare outcomes and 54th in fairness of our system. In fact, the only thing we rank number one in is cost. We pay twice as much as the average industrialized country for our health care, and we're still excluding, you know, a third of the country if you include the people who are uninsured or underinsured. Underinsured meaning they cannot access the care they need. We also hear this idea of rationing, that if we move to a national health care system, we'll have rationing, when the reality is we experience the most severe form of rationing in this country, and that is the financial barrier to care. You only get good care if you can pay for it, and if you can't, then you're out of luck. So the idea that we would experience rationing in this country is almost laughable when you look at the severe rationing that is actually happening. And there's really answers to all of these popular myths and misconceptions. Many of them you can find at Healthcare Now's website, www.healthcare-now.org, as well as our allied our sister organization, Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. Great information is found at all of those sites. You can sign up, you can join Healthcare Now for free. We send out regular updates and action alerts about what's happening on the national level as well as the local level. And like I said, we have organizers in over 40 states, and you can find a list of them at our website so you can get involved with what is happening locally. But the most important thing you can do right now is call your representatives and tell them that you support H.R. 676. There's also Senate legislation, Senate Bill 703, introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders just last week. And those are the two bills that we're really pushing. Tell everyone you know about single payer. Learn more. Have house parties. Organize demonstrations in front of insurance companies. And we've got all of these campaigns underway, so we're happy to help you get started as well at healthcare-now.org.
All right, Katie, thanks so much for all you're doing on this campaign, and appreciate you joining us tonight. We'll check in again to talk more about, healthcare and single payer in particular as your campaign moves forward and as the President and Congress move forward with their plans. Hopefully there's some good news coming up.
Absolutely. But we got to work hard. Thanks,
yeah,
Scott.
It won't happen without hard work. Thank you again, Katie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You will.
Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator of Healthcare Now. And again, it's healthcare-now.org for the website and all sorts of information. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. This program is Counterpoint. We're here every Monday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. Glad you could join us. We're back next week, of course, at 8. But wanted to let you know that you can get a copy of this program, usually from WhiteRoseSociety.org. Now, I understand that White Rose Society has had some trouble picking up our new stream from our newly converted WPKN.org website, so the archiving there may have some flaws over the past few weeks, but we're working to rectify that, and hopefully it will be. And there may be some alternatives quite soon on WPKN's own website. And for more information, just check out the website, wpkn.org. And for that, archiving audio of all the programs here, as well as the opportunity to get a little more familiar with our program schedule and make a secure online contribution to keep this station going. We are listener-supported and depend on you to remain on the airwaves. And our radio show, Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, which airs here on WPKN, every Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. with repeat broadcasts, Saturdays at 2, and the following Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. That website is www.btlonline.org, and you can get full audio archives going back many, many years to all of our interviews, some of them heard here in their original long form and edited down later for the other shows that we place them in, namely Between the Lines. So with that said, thank you all for listening, and we're going to be back with an interview about the Left Form in just a moment after we take a musical break. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And we know what we're knowing, but we can't say what we've seen. And we're not little children, and we know what we want.
Talking Heads from way back when. We're on the road to nowhere, and seems like that a lot of times, doesn't it? But there's hope in the wind, and a lot of organizing going around in this country, as we just discussed with our previous guest on single-payer health care. People are striving to make changes. And just to remind you, this is WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk. The program is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and I'm very happy to introduce right now Seth Adler, conference coordinator with The Left Forum, a gathering of progressive intellectuals and activists from around the world. This year's Left Forum is titled Turning Points, addressing the many facets of the current economic crisis and the opportunities for progressive alternatives. The conference will be taking place this Friday through Sunday, April 17th through the 19th, at New York City's Pace University. Seth, thanks so much for being here tonight.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is great. I always look forward to the Left Forum and have been to many of them. As they used to be called the Socialist Scholars Conference, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the history of these conferences that have been taking place for many, many years now.
That's right. It's probably about three decades now, starting back at the Borough of Manhattan Community College, when people like Stanley Aronowitz and Francis Piven, some of the scholar activists, public intellectuals of the New York area, felt that there needed to be a movement in academe more towards activism and vice versa, really, a movement in activism towards the thought-provoking, the analytical, the theoretical, and out of that, plus, you could say, many of the currents of the new left at that time arose this sort of large, unwieldy conference at the borough called the Socialist Scholars Conference, and which happily proceeded in its big tent for about two and a half decades. After that, the same founders and organizers changed the name, moved the venue. Times were changing, I guess you could say. And the term left, broad left, progressive, radical, sort of captured the imagination at that point, and the idea of a forum also, as the Socialist Scholars was, also became pertinent, and they named it Left Forum. It then moved to Cooper Union in Manhattan and grew from a size of, let's say, 1,000 or so to double and more. And this latest move is to Pace University. Cooper Union was renovated sort of late last year, and there were many scholars from Pace University and activists, too, who had participated both in the Socialist Scholars as well as the Cooper Union Left Forum, and they invited themselves, in a sense, as well as some of the other organizers, into Pace to produce what is now probably going to be the largest conference of the Left Forum history, and maybe the Socialist Scholars, too.
Yeah, well, we certainly want to get a flavor of what's going to be happening this weekend, and I'll be attending at least a day or two to try and record some of the panels and bringing that back here to the airwaves. But there's how many workshops you guys have? It was an enormous number I saw.
It is. It's unwieldy in many ways, and there are 200 or so. And if you add the artistic events that are taking place, the various from theater to photographic journalism to artists showing their work, the large book fair and organizational sort of tables that are set out too, you've got such a large sort of gathering and milieu. But that's around 200 or so panels and events that take place during seven sessions throughout the weekend, preceded by a student teach-in at Pace, which has the students doing panels and roundtables and other forms of discussion, sort of feeding into the conference itself on Friday night. There are about 600 speakers all told, who will be, both presenting and going to the various panels themselves.
I would say that, as someone who's watched with great admiration the growth of the World Social Forum and the regional social forums that have taken off around the world, including here recently in Atlanta, Georgia, it looked to your gathering, your event, your annual event, Left Forum, as really a predecessor of the World Social Forum, you know, with maybe more of an emphasis on the academia. But, of course, you've always invited the participation of activists as well. And I'm wondering, you've got this year's Left Forum is titled Turning Points. What's really kind of like the overarching theme here in mission of this year's event?
Oh, it's trifold in a sense. I could tell you it by just talking about the plenaries. And indeed, though, you're right, the organizers of the World Social Forum, very aware of the Socialist Scholars Conference and its activist sort of roots in the radical traditions in the left in New York, the only thing being there was sort of nothing like it elsewhere, whereas the World Social Forum organizers realized that the idea of a gathering where, both thought and practice are combined, it could have a dynamic for many parts of the world. So, indeed, there is a connection. The theme of Turning Points has to do with both the economic problems or the economic crises we're facing, but also their multiple cultural, social, political, environmental dimensions. There's a very holistic cast to the framing of the opening plenary, which is about this current crisis in its multiple dimensions, and the turning points also that are apparent there. On Saturday and Sunday, sort of move further through exploring, well, what are the turning points in the world situation, in the national, in the regional, in the local, in the communities? Where are turning points that people who are of a sort of left or radical bent are engaged in or can create, and more broadly, where are the fissures and cracks sort of in the economic, social, environmental, and cultural processes that seem to be emerging with potentials for change as well as challenges for peril? And the Saturday night plenary addresses a much more specific sort of applied politics of the Obama campaign and presidency and lessons for the left, or lessons for the great spectrum of left-inflected movements. And Sunday closes with a plenary on the theme Turning Points, sort of just articulated in the way I did. And I can tell you some of the speakers who will be speaking on these plenaries, and the great variety of panels. Also, to answer your question, there is indeed an emphasis, in a sense, on what's come in from both the hinterlands and around the world as activists and scholars, what the organizers have felt is important for them to present. The economic dimensions of our current predicament and crises are taking sort of the largest sway of panels. So we have panels, for example, what is the nature of the economic crisis, with Bill Tabb, Anwar Shaikh, and Rick Wolf, on the brink of depression, turning points in world capitalism, nationalize the banks. What does it really mean? I mean, is there a sense of nationalizing the banks from the ground up when you're dealing with these, with money systems that seem so abstract? Well, yes, here, union activists and people like Doug Henwood and David Harvey and Nomi Prince and others will be debating these things. Imperialism in the global economic crisis, so almost anything, money, barrels, and change. You connect the environmental crises to also some of the financial issues. So for the plenaries, the big events on the three nights, we have Walden Bellow, also from focused on the Global South, and he's known as, you know, one of the instigators of the World Social Forum as well as one of its greatest critics. Katja Kipping of Die Linke, the left party in Germany, is also a sort of a great activist to listen to. Adolf Reed Jr., a pretty severe critic of Obama from the University of Pennsylvania, probably known for some of his writings on the African-American politics before and now after Obama. Rick Wolf, Richard D. Wolf, author of Knowledge and Class from UMass Amherst and now the New School, is sort of representing the Marxist economics analysis. And Arlie Hochschild, a sociologist extraordinaire, writing on the second shift on women's issues are presenting for the first plenary. On the second plenary, it's the Obama one. Bill Fletcher Jr., a well-known activist and organizer in labor, as well as editor of the Black Commentator, is moderating a roundtable. It's sort of a new form for these big plenaries because it's more of an interview dialogue style with people, Stanley Aronowitz, Francis Piven, Gihan Pereira from the Miami Workers Center, a young, incredibly talented organizer from that part of the world, and one of the founders of Right to the City, and Barbara Ransby, a scholar and activist from the University of Illinois, along with Barbara Epstein from out west, all have different and fascinating positions on this sort of extraordinary sea change in electoral politics. And then the last plenary, closing it out, is on Turning Points, and it has Medea Benjamin, Joanna Brenner, a sociologist and political scholar and activist from Portland, Kate Bronfenbrenner, director of labor education research in Cornell University, and by Ravi Desai, who's the executive director of the New York City Taxi Workers Alliance. They're closing out the evening. We also have some performances on Friday night from the Cradle Will Rock. This is PACE's Actors Studio and a master's program or acting program. The Cradle Will Rock, we have some other performances going on that evening in a small segment that sort of closes off the Friday opening.
It's an enormous amount of activities and workshops, and what a bunch of great activists and intellectuals, as the conference is described, all gathered in one place for this three-day conference. Again, we're speaking with Seth Adler, conference coordinator with the Left Forum, which will be taking place this Friday through Sunday, April 17th through 19th at New York City's Pace University. The website is leftform.org, and we'll repeat that before we say goodbye. But Seth, I wanted to ask you about some criticism of these gatherings is that in the end it's just so much talk. Is there any kind of coordination on future action or campaigns, activities, things that translate to tangible on the street kinds of work in the effort to make change?
Among the many questions I would have is, what does one mean by so much talk? That phrase could mean many things, but among activists, there is so much talk so-called out on the street that maybe, unlike so much talk within the walls of a particular place, and there it may be a rarefied experience that there is so much talk within framed as a dialogue to come to understandings about, the type of talk that we find both out on the streets in activism and behind closed doors in the organizational milieu. So in some ways one can think, just if you don't mind, I'm riffing on your idea of so much talk, that talk can be activism, especially at critical times where questions are opened up about ways forward, about turning points, about where are the challenges, about how organizations may have been stymied in the past or are stymied, where are the gains, where are the challenges. All of this at some point not only boils down to talk and discourse, but the languages of different groups sometimes becomes jaded, alienated, different, challenging, misunderstood. And so the question is, where are the places, if there are many sort of fragments of progressive activity out there in the streets, so-called, where are the places to understand, if only, what the differences are, but how to even discuss and talk about differences, how to understand the commonalities if you don't understand the differences, where groups are brought together in, this scope and at this level, like the World Social Forum. It is indeed a place for the type of talk and the type of networking that has a different character than can be organized out on the streets.
Well, you have my agreement. I think this is a positive thing. We have so much need for talk to clarify these very issues you just ran down. And what's more important this year, maybe than in previous years or even previous decades since the conference got underway, Seth, is that it seems we're in a special moment in history, given the economic collapse and the decline of the conventional wisdom of capitalism and how we organize this economy. I think it's a real moment where we can all challenge it. You know, people who voted Republican or Democratic in the past can all stand up and challenge the Reagan-Hoover philosophy of cowboy capitalism, deregulation, and privatization. So I would ask you if you feel, as I do, and I know many other people do, that there is great peril at this moment in history, but there's also great opportunity to make change in a progressive direction that may not come up again for another generation or two.
Absolutely, and I appreciate you putting it that way, because in many senses, if we listen to sort of the mainstream language discourse talk about ways out of the economic crisis that, admittedly, from Greenspan to Obama, they've never seen anything like it before. Maybe the Great Depression, but most have not seen that. And there are other dimensions that we can add of environmental peril that make it even more challenging. You watch sort of symbolically Greenspan with his hands on his head, or something like this, saying, you know, everything I learned in these paradigms, these utopian paradigms of the neoclassical economics, doesn't explain what's going on now. And you can repeat that type of, sort of lack of a dynamic dialogue, the lack of even knowing the languages, we could say languages of progressives and radicals about solidarity economies, about cooperatives, about collectives, about workers organizing from the ground up, about, you know, all of these languages that are in the milieu and are, you know, in some ways can, at this point, they make more sense to people, even to the point that while Democrats will not be talking about nationalization and socialism, you listen to the airwaves and the conservative pundits, they almost snicker, and they're not just making fun of it. They're saying, well, maybe we can have a little dose of socialism here or nationalization. Of course, we'll put our CEO in General Motors to make it all happen, but nonetheless, it opens the way that hasn't seemed to have been for decades now, to bring forth the radical imagination in these type of languages and to make them more forceful, because the public sphere is starting to be more infused with this language that is, you know, we hope sort of giving this time for us to bring forth these challenges and to address the perils.
Former conservative British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was famous for saying there is no alternative, which I guess is later boiled down to the acronym TINA. There is no alternative to this neoliberal drive for this cowboy crony capitalism that we saw melt down in recent months. But obviously there has to be an alternative, and I think that's why this conference you're organizing, Seth, is so important, that we need to come up with alternatives, and it can't just be, you know, the new Lawrence Summers versus the old Lawrence Summers, because, hey, I don't think there's a great deal of difference there, which is another whole issue we could debate. But, we need some alternatives outside the box, and that's why these discussions at the Left Forum coming up this weekend in New York City seem to me so important. How do you think we're going to arrive there? And I'll just tell you, my own concern is that the left is perpetually so disorganized and chaotic. Some of it for good reason. Everybody wants to go their own direction. But how do you see this playing out? Are we apt to stumble upon some unifying themes and programs here that we can all rally around and move forward on?
Oh, it's a tremendous challenge. Some would say that the multiplicity, the multitude, the rising tide of great diversity in struggle is, you know, part of the momentum that's happening right now. And so your question sort of asks for, is there more certainty in answers that are both, you know, coherent and unifying? And I imagine yes, in a number of ways, amidst all of the cacophony and sort of desires of people to have both coherence and multiplicity at the same time. it's, you know, the type of solutions and alternatives that are being proposed at the Left Forum and also have a more of a platform elsewhere are ones that are comprehensive, usually, and holistic, and do imply the need to address the great problem of political power, that is, for radicals and leftists and progressives. The issue of developing and even discussing political power is a very tough one. So these are some of the crucial dialogues that are taking place at this forum, and else will go on elsewhere, all over, I imagine, all over the world at this point. We can only say that sometimes it doesn't seem to have the type of presence in the public sphere that really represents the amount of activity, cultural, intellectual, political, that is manifest in the world today around progressive and radical and coherent motion forward in organizing. But it is there. It's just harder to find places to articulate it.
Well, Seth, we're almost out of time here, but I just want to emphasize to anyone listening who's got an interest in progressive politics and activism and the science of politics and economics at this moment of crisis in the world should look closely at the Left Forum website. That's leftforum.org, where you can take a look at the more than 200 workshops and, as Seth said, the other, you know, arts activities, photojournalist exhibits, a film festival that's taking place concurrently there at Pace University, and the topics are just they range from economics, journalism, labor, gender, ecology, and the environment. Food, religion, art, the Middle East, Latin America, Marxist theory, political and social movements around the world, healthcare and housing, and that's just a small smattering of these topics and workshops from intellectuals and activists from all over the country and around the world. So this is exciting, Seth, and yeah. I'm planning to be there. And maybe the last word you can give our listeners on this is, how would they register? What do they got to do? Can they just show up? And certainly feel free to give the website and the phone number out as well.
Absolutely. You mentioned the website where you can register. That will be closing down in a day or so. We encourage people to come to Pace. It's One Pace Plaza right across the street from City Hall Park, downtown Manhattan. Very easy to get to by almost all the subways. The registration starts on Friday at around 5 p.m. And you can also call us here at 212-817-2003. It's 212-817-2003. We don't charge much to get in. We really want all who can come to come. It's important for everybody to participate in what is really a sort of participant-driven event. That is, while there are panels, there are also key to everything is the discussion, the dialogue that takes place as much in the hallways as it is in the rooms where everybody is presented with ample time to comment and participate.
All right, Seth. Thanks again for doing all this hard work to organize this conference. I know it'll be well worth it, yeah. And I look forward to hoping to meet you when we get over there.
Absolutely.
On the weekend.
Can't wait to see you.
All right, Seth. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye. That was Seth Adler, Conference Coordinator of Left Forum. And again, the website, leftforum.org. We're going to take a quick musical break. Here's some music from Steve Earle as we make way for our final segment. On the topic of immigration, we'll be speaking with Jorge Mujica. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a little bit. Revolution. And this is WPKM in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk, New York. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. And right now I'd like to welcome to the program Jorge Mujica. He's a March 10th coalition organizer and one of the lead organizers of the May Day Immigrants' Rights March in Chicago that drew more than a third of a million people back in 2006. Mr. Mujica will be speaking at a Trinity College forum on immigration rights, a forum to discuss just immigration reform. That's going to be this Thursday at Trinity College, and the forum starts at 7 p.m. Thank you so much for joining us here, Jorge. I appreciate it.
We just flaunt them, and we say no.
Can you hear me okay?
Wait a second. Okay.
Okay,
now
Jorge.
I hear you well.
Good. Jorge, just tell us a little bit about your background. Now, I just have to tell you from my perspective, I actually was caught dead out, flat out surprised and shocked by the number of people who came out to march in the streets all across this country, in the millions, against what the Republican Congress at the time back in 2006 was,
right,
was trying to do with some very harsh new laws on immigration. But you had a leading role in what would, you know, had to take America and the world by surprise. And you guys are one of the most successful organizers of any protest march I've ever seen. So tell us a little bit in terms of just the history of that. What happened to make it such a success?
Well, basically what happened is that the United States was dragging a wrong policy for the longest time. When people ask me where this movement was born or when, what I tell them is it was born when the United States approved legislation back in 1984, the so-called amnesty, and they left out a half a million people, and they declared them undocumented, and then the count started rising every day, every day, every day, until you get 12 million people. You know, the birth of the movement wasn't our doing. The birth of the movement was the doing of a wrong law, a wrong immigration system that never thought about the future of immigration. And, you know, very skippy policy on today you can legalize and tomorrow you can't, and then on Thursday you can again, and then on Friday you can't. If you apply those kind of policies, what you get is millions of people with parents, daughters, sons, cousins, fiancés, and whatever, who are legal residents and who are willing to fight for those who don't have documents. That's how we gathered millions of people, you know.
And Jorge, tell us about the March 10th coalition that you're part of, the committee. What work have you been doing since 06? I know that you haven't been quiet. You've been actually very busy doing a lot of work. But tell our listeners what's up. And I know you've got some plans for this May Day, May 1st.
Well, what we have been doing is keeping the issue of immigration alive and well and thought about and spoken about. You know, public policies in the United States change like the wind. You know, today is the economy, tomorrow may be violence, and on Friday maybe something else. So what we've been doing is keeping alive the issue of immigration. Although we realize that you don't fix immigration in a week, we many times feel that nobody's paying enough attention to immigration, except those who oppose immigration. And obviously we don't like that. So what we've been doing is keep talking about it, keep saying and repeating, you know, the policies of immigration are not working. We have been proposing things, we have been proposing policies, and in this particular time, this particular year where Obama took office, what we said is, listen, he is not going to fix the system, but Obama, President Obama, could do at least 10 things that don't depend on Congress and that could start solving part of the immigration issue. Examples of that, the NOMADS letters, the Social Security Administration sends out letters every year if your Social Security and your number don't coincide with the Social Security database. Supposedly, that doesn't even have an immigration purpose. Supposedly, that's to fix the Social Security database error. The problem is that when an employer and a worker get a NOMADS letter, they immediately think this is about immigration, and the worker gets fired. And the only consequence is that the worker gets another job in another place and keeps being exploited. It doesn't solve anything, but you don't have to be, you know, losing your job every year because of a NOMADS Social Security Administration letter. So that's kind of, you know, small policies that affect a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people every year, and Mr. Obama could change that. So we are making suggestions, you know, for how to start solving or keep discussing at least the immigration issue.
So you have plans for some marches on or other activities on May 1st, May Day this year, right?
Absolutely, yes. And let me tell you, the spirit, the feeling in the streets is a lot stronger this year than last year. Last year we, I wouldn't call it a split, but we had a difference in the movement. Many people saying what we should do is organize for the elections, you know, bringing people to the polls, registering voters, and I don't know. And we said, well, yeah, we should do that, but at the same time, we should keep marching. It's the public part of the movement. It's public pressure. Of course, voting is another part of the process, but we should keep the things public. And this year is like, okay, there is no more political campaign to organize. There is no more elections upcoming, so what we should do is march. So we're going to be marching on May Day, I think in larger numbers than last year, because it's also like sending the administration a message. Okay, we are not under Bush anymore. We are not under Senate and House of Representatives dominated by Republicans. So you have to do something, and you have to start doing it this year. As a matter of fact, I think President Obama already got the message, because he already promised that after May Day, he's going to make an announcement on how to start discussing immigration reform.
Well, Jorge Mojica is our guest tonight. He's part of the March 10th Coalition and organizer of the May Day giant immigration rights march in Chicago that drew more than 300,000 people back in 2006, with a new march planned on this May Day, May 1st. And Jorge, what do you make of President Obama and where he may be going with immigration reform? There's a lot of talk, as there was with some compromise legislation within the last couple of years, that there needs to be a path to legalization. What does that sound like to you?
Well, it sounds good. That is the part that sounds good. The other parts don't. because basically, mostly, Mr. Obama keeps linking immigration to national security. That's the part we don't like. It's one thing about to talk about immigration enforcement, you know, for employers that don't comply with certain rules and so on and on. That's fine. But talking about securing the border before talking about legalization, we don't like that message. Because to us, you know, the threats to national security of the United States don't come across the border. Across the border come people who want to hide and work and hide after work and go back to work and keep hiding. So the two issues don't mix well. National security should be addressed in the sense that the southern border may be very porous in terms of piracy, you know, for business. How do you call that in English? I'm sorry, I'm not even thinking about it. But you know, products and merchandise that is pirates that doesn't comply with international law. Border security in terms of arms trafficking, yes. Border security in terms of drug dealing, yes. Those are issues, but those are not related to immigration. So we want to separate both things. One is national security, and the other one is immigration. And immigration responds to economic markets in the sense of how many jobs are available in the United States, and the United States does not have enough citizens to fulfill those jobs. You know, the U.S. economy was creating, according to George Bush, and maybe he lied also on that issue, but at least he used to say that the U.S. economy was creating 200,000 jobs a month. Well, you don't have enough citizens for those jobs. You simply don't have them. I mean, go back to the basic statistics. You don't have enough citizens. You need international workers. So the whole issue of immigration should be resolved on those bases. How many available jobs are there for international workers, and what kind of jobs? And that would be the future of immigration, not based on, you know, family unity, but based on, okay, we have so many jobs, we need so many international workers of some kind. That's it. Let's do it that way.
Well, our guest tonight is Jorge Mujica, and again, of the March 10th Coalition, and he's going to be organizing demonstrations this May Day, advocating a just immigration reform solution in this country. Jorge, what, tell us about the DREAM Act. It's a piece of legislation, is it not, that some immigrants' rights advocates have gotten behind. What is the DREAM Act?
The DREAM Act is a very interesting piece of legislation. It's also controversial, as it is right now. The DREAM Act says students, people, undocumented immigrants who really didn't come here but were brought here by their parents when they were, you know, before 5 years of age, 10 years of age, the decision to cross the border wasn't there. The decision to get them across the border was their parents. So these people shouldn't be blamed. They should be good students, you know, to have finished high school. And if they comply with all those requirements, then there should be a path for legalization for them. That's the good part, the nice part. The not-so-good part is that the DREAM Act provides for a step after step after step in the legalization process. And part of those steps is that you couldn't get your final legal permanent residency until you prove that you have at least completed 2 years of higher education or that you have served 2 years in the military. So the fear in the immigration movement is that the Army doesn't make two-year contracts. You know, the Army gets you for 4 years and then renewable for another 4 years. So for many students who are obviously poor, who couldn't afford higher education, the only way out would be the Army. So critics of the DREAM Act say that this is a recruitment kind of, you know, cover recruitment law, and they don't like it because of that. I don't like it personally, because what I think is we need legalization for all. And so if we get legalization for all, why do we have to separate the students from the rest? I don't like, you know, really non-solution for 60,000 people when we have a problem with 12 million undocumented immigrants.
Well, thank you for that. And Jorge, maybe you could talk a little bit about leaders in Congress that you're working with to craft some legislation that, as you say, you want to keep enforcement separate from immigration normalization and a path to legalization. Are there some legislators that you're working with in that effort?
We are trying to, but so far none of them have been very willing to start talking about the issue. What they say is they are really waiting for the direction of the White House. They want to see where Obama stands on the issue of immigration before committing or compromising to do any effort on their part. In Spanish, we used to say, you know, if you move, you don't come out well in the picture. So nobody's willing to move at this time. They want, you know, to be in the picture, but they want to be very clear on the picture. So they are waiting. One legislature, actually, we are working with, believe it or not, is the very controversial senator from Illinois, Roland Burris. Roland Burris, you know, because of the way in which he was named to the Senate and so on, he's maybe controversial, but he's very willing to work with us because he has been working in the past a lot with us. So we are working with him. We already gave him the beginning of a blueprint for immigration reform.
Jorge Mojica, we've gotten a lot of news reports over the last weeks and months about escalating violence on the U.S.-Mexican border, drug gangs battling it out, many civilians and police caught in the crossfire, stories of rampant corruption among police and law enforcement in Mexico. Do you think that the attention on this violence and the drug traffickers and all that is going to have a negative effect, or what effect, if any, do you think it will have on the debate on immigration reform this year?
No, I really think those issues are not linked. I mean, my personal opinion on the all of a sudden discovery of violence in Mexico in the part of the United States is the upcoming visit of President Obama to Mexico. I mean, we have had violence in Mexico for the last 3 years in a row, ever since President Calderon started his campaign against drug trafficking. And the violence has been the same. It's not the last month. It's not the last year. It's been 3 years in a row. The United States didn't pay attention to that until President Obama announces that he's going to go to Mexico. And then all of a sudden, everybody discovers that there's violence in Mexico. I think, my personal opinion is that this is part of the campaign previous to Obama's visit. You know, the most vulnerable you make the Mexican government before the meeting of the two presidents, you know, the more prone they would be to accept certain conditions from the United States. One of them, for instance, is that the United States has always wanted U.S. agents to operate freely in Mexican territory, meaning the CIA, the DEA. They want them to run the country, you know, fully armed and do whatever operations they deem necessary without consulting with the Mexican government. And all of a sudden, the issue revives, you know, because there's a lot of violence in Mexico and President Obama is going to be visiting the country. I don't think it's related. I tell you again, I recognize that violence around the border is, or it may be, a U.S. national security issue. But that's not related with immigration whatsoever.
Okay. Well, Jorge Mojica is our guest tonight, and he will be coming to a forum, a public forum, to discuss just immigration reform, and that'll be at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, 7 p.m., for more information, I'm just going to give a number out here, Jorge, 860-538-3920. I'll repeat that. But, Jorge, what message are you bringing to this forum up in Hartford later this week on Thursday?
Well, the basic message that I'm bringing is we have to keep the pressure on President Obama and the Democratic Congress. It's one thing to understand, you know, that Republicans were a lot more hesitant to tackle on the issue of immigration reform. And another thing is to believe that Democrats by themselves and President Obama by himself is going to, you know, get us to full legalization and immigration reform. We don't believe so. There are many interests at hand. You know, whenever an employer can pay less than minimum wage for hiring a worker and exploiting that worker, he's going to try to do that. And if you keep having 10 to 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, employers are going to keep doing that, and that's unfair. So they are lobbying for non-immigration reform in order to keep paying less than minimum wage. So we have to put the pressure on Congress and the White House in order to get full immigration reform. And in the meantime, from now till the year we get full immigration reform, the administration should be putting into effect some measures. We already are advancing on the issue of rates in the workplace. Janet Napolitano, the head of national security, already declared that more than having workplace rates against the workers, they are going to go after the employers. Well, that's a good beginning, but still, we are already seeing the counter effect of that kind of measure, because now some employers say, you know, I'm under risk. You know, I could get fined, I could get jailed if I hire you. So I'm going to hire you, but I'm not going to pay you not even the minimum wage, and I'm not going to make any contributions to the Social Security number, and I'm going to insure you, I am not going to insure you on workers' compensation, and so on and on. So there are some partial measures that could be taken, but we want the administration to take them after really thinking well about them, you know, not just because it looks right. And we have to keep the pressure on for small measures until we get the big full legalization for all.
One thing I know you're probably concerned about as I'm thinking about this issue, there's a lot of potential for scapegoating immigrants at a time of economic decline, as we're seeing and living through right now, where, you know, many people who are losing their jobs can very easily cite immigrants as somebody who's stealing their work or whatever. And, you know, you only have to look at the television and see people like Lou Dobbs and other folks who, you know, are acting as real kind of zealots on this immigration issue and playing a very, I think, negative role in you know, how people view their neighbors, whatever ethnicity they are. So, Jorge, what do you think about that? Is that something that concerns you right now?
Well, yes, absolutely, because they have been the dominant force on the immigration debate. You know, on one side, they dominate the media and they talk about horrendous things by immigrants. They even lie publicly, like Lutov saying that, I don't remember the number exactly he gave, but the last 36,000 cases of tuberculosis were brought to the United States by illegal aliens. This kind of thing, which is, you know, not even based on statistics or anything like that. That's one thing, but the other one is, if they keep dominating the media, then they will keep portraying immigrants as the culprits for anything and everything that happened. I remember not a long time ago, a few years back, when the wildfires in Arizona were blamed on immigrants, because they say, you know, immigrants make fires at night to keep warm in the desert, and so they are the culprits for the natural wildfires. We have to counter that, definitely. We have to counter that by telling people the truth. And it's not very difficult to do it. You know, it's very simple, because every statistic benefits us. Now, in terms of the economic crisis, we have to recognize one thing. We are people who move from place to find a better job, a better working conditions, and therefore a better life. If there were no jobs in the United States, immigration would stop. And even further, if there were no jobs in the United States, U.S. citizens would start moving to a place where they could find jobs. What I mean is, let's suppose that we don't come out of the economic crisis. Let's suppose that we go deeper into it. United States citizens would move to Germany, to Japan, to China, to Brazil, and wherever they could find jobs. And then they would understand what the immigration movement is all about.
Right.
I mean, people move freely from, what do I say, California to New York if they find a better job. But if they move across an international border, you know, people like Ludov say, oh, my God, you know, they are invading us. That's not true. People would move anywhere, wherever they can get a better job. And that's the basics 101 of immigration. In times of crisis, you don't have jobs, you won't get immigration. That's it, period.
Well, we're out of time, Jorge Mujica. I thank you so much for spending time with us tonight and remind listeners that they can see you in a panel of other activists and other spokespeople on the immigration issue at a public forum to discuss just immigration reform, and that'll take place this Thursday, April 16th, on the campus of Trinity College. It's an event sponsored by the group Stop the Raids, and a phone number for more information is 860-538-3920, 860-538-3920. So, Jorge, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks to you. Thank you very much. And I will be seeing you on Thursday.
Have a good trip here to Connecticut from Chicago.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And just a last note before we say goodnight and make way for JF, who's going to be up here behind this mic in just a moment. I was just handed a note before we left the air that May 1st there will be a march on the New Haven Green in support of immigration rights. That's going to start at 7 p.m. May 1st. And I'm not sure of the day of the week May 1st falls on this year, but we're going to be looking at a calendar and digging that up for you. But right now we got JF coming up next. This is WPKN of Bridgeport at 89.5 FM. And who's this in the studio? This is not JF. It doesn't look like JF.
No.
What do you guys got coming up here tonight?
No interviews, but I've got the notorious cherry bombs.
The notorious cherry bombs.
Yeah, I've decided I've changed my theme song.
Oh, okay.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, that's dangerous. I better get myself out of here and make way for your theme song. But you're going to be joining this character?
Yeah, I was here last week. He's here this week. He misplaced something. So
okay.
I was going to fill into him, yeah.
All right. Well,
don't forget to contribute to PKN. The pledge drive is still on.
It's still on. And our website is WPKN.org. Make a secure online contribution there. We are listener supported. No corporate grants. No government grants. You're the people who keep us alive and breathing. WPKN.org. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week, next Monday evening between 8 and 10 for another program that we call Counterpoint. Stay tuned. These guys here are next.
The life that it's bound to live. A sun and moon in a miner's tomb is all they ask in the Lord to give. But politics and big events, they never seem to notice the little guy. Make a plan, or simply hold a hand, but don't ever be a passerby. Tolerance or violence, and the whole world goes to war. Is one enough? One too many before we say no more. Could you ever love how it goes? Could you? strangers' eyes. Give a little tolerance, tolerance. Need you more and more. Lend a hand, or hold a friend. That's a need for life support. Draw a picture.
How you doing out there tonight? That's good. That's good. This is, when I was growing up, me and my dad used to go at it all the time. Over almost anything. But, I used to have really long hair, way down past my shoulders. I was 17 or 18. Oh man, I used to hate it. And we got to where we'd fight so much that I'd spend a lot of time out of the house. And in the summertime, it wasn't so bad, because it was warm and friends were out. But in the winter, I remember standing downtown and it would get so cold. And when the wind would blow, I had this phone booth that I used to stand in. And I used to call my girl like for hours at a time, just talking to her all night long. And finally, I get my nerve up to go home. And I'd stand there in the driveway, and he'd be waiting for me in the kitchen. And I'd tuck my hair down on my collar, and I'd walk in, and he'd call me back to sit down with him. And the first thing he'd always ask me was, what did I think I was doing with myself? And the worst part about it was I could never explain it to him.
I remember I got in a motorcycle accident once, and I was laid up in bed, and he had a barber come in and cut my hair.